Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Where to start when the news of the day isn't so different from the last four trading days? We could tell you Wall Street didn't open quite as badly as everybody expected. We might mention the foreign exchange markets and how currency traders are driving some of what's been happening. Or we could say hold on to your hats because nobody really knows how long the ride's going to last. You know what? I think we'll say all three. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, March 5th today. Great to have you with us. I woke up early this morning, took a glance at the Asian market results on the wires, and I figured, oh man, it's going to be another one of those days. From Shanghai down to Hong Kong, across India into Europe, the major indices closed lower than where they'd started the day. So you know where this one's going. Talking heads were predicting more of the same on Wall Street once the opening bell rang. All you have to do is look at last week to know stock markets like to follow each other down. And we got some of that in New York today. Investors at least tried to keep things positive. Things were up before they went down. But Marketplace's Bob Moon reminds us there's more happening out there than just people buying and selling stocks. For the second straight trading day, the foreign exchange markets had unusual influence over worries about something called the carry trade.
Borrowing yen for close to free and then reinvesting in higher yield currencies and assets in other countries seemed for a time almost like minting money. But since the yen and other cheap currencies have begun to rise in value, speculators have had to rush to, quite literally, cover their assets. The trauma that's caused has some investors worrying this could all keep feeding on itself. And Jefferies & Company chief market analyst Art Hogan says that's sending shockwaves well beyond the Tokyo stock market.
Look at Asia Pacific in general. You're seeing a sell-off on the fears that, you know, what's going on really might be a precursor to a global economic slowdown. And I think that's why we see the sell-off in Asia sort of work its way through Europe and over to the United States.
Wall Street investors hate that kind of uncertainty, but Hogan remains optimistic. The markets here just need a little reassurance.
My guess is sometime this week we'll come in and Asian markets overnight won't have been down, and we might even see some bounce 1 or 2 days in a row. I think that'll sort of signal that most of this has worked its way through the system. We've had a pretty violent sell-off. It's very abrupt and very sharp. So, you know, typically those types of corrections don't last a long period of time, and I think this will be no different.
Others aren't so sure. Bank of America securities strategist Tom McManus sent a note to clients today cautioning that it's too soon to commit new funds to the market. And at Forex.com, research director Brian Dolan suggests there's more than just fear driving the decline on overseas markets. He says investors who had borrowed cheap yen when the markets were stable are reacting to very real losses.
Depending when you got in, you could be looking at a significant 5 to 6% move against your underlying asset. And so whatever you might have gained is now wiped out and is probably negative. So these people are selling not just out of a panic, they're selling because they're starting to lose a lot of money.
Some analysts believe that investments using the yen and other cheap currencies, such as the Swiss franc, have been helping push the U.S. stock market to the record highs it saw before last week. And they fear it may take some time to regain that momentum if an important source of fuel is now gone. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Picking up where Bob left off, today makes it 3 days in a row the dollar's fallen against the yen. It hit a three-month low before getting some of it back. The other factor driving investors today were the mortgage market, specifically companies that traffic in subprime loans, typically riskier investments that have been going bad with increasing frequency the past couple of months. A real estate investment trust called New Century Financial Corporation lost 68% of its market value today. We've told you more than once on the program about China's breathtaking economic growth and how the government in Beijing seems to like capitalism just fine, thanks, which might raise the question of where all the socialists have gone. Well, they're still around, and they were making waves on the first day of the yearly meeting of the Chinese parliament today in Beijing. But Marketplace's Scott Tong reports most eyes are on a few other pressing business matters.
The National People's Congress tends to be an annual choreographed event, a bit like rubber stamping. But occasionally, debates do break out. Two main proposals are expected to pass this session. First, a plan to enshrine the right of private property. Proponents think it's just a natural step along the free market road. but a group of hardcore leftists claims that it castrates the spirit of the Constitution.
They use the phrase of China changing its color, color being red.
Economist William Hess is with a forecasting firm, Global Insight.
There's a lot of resentment towards the way that this privatization has taken place. In many cases, the transactions have been very opaque. You know, a big state-owned factory may have been transferred to some well-connected individuals at a fire sale price.
The leftists will lose this battle, but it's part of what Hess considers a larger debate over wealth, corruption, and privilege in China. The issue of privilege is at the center of the second debate, too, a plan to take away special tax breaks for foreign companies. Right now, they pay a rate of 15% versus 33% for local firms. Arthur Krober of the consulting firm Dragonomics says China started giving this special treatment in the 1980s.
It's a way of enticing foreign investors into what was perceived at that time as a very hostile environment, because China was just emerging from its communist past.
Today, though, China will soon pass Germany as the world's number three economy. And Krober says the tax break has outlived its usefulness. But Lester Ross of the American Chamber of Commerce disagrees.
Many Chinese domestic companies actually don't pay at the full tax rate. Or if they do pay at the full tax rate, they don't report all of their income.
Perhaps a decent argument, but at this session, likely a losing one. In Beijing, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The U.S. Patent Office is joining the Internet age. The government wants your help in deciding what new ideas deserve to be protected. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Last year, patent examiners slogged their way through over 300,000 applications by reviewing technical journals, annual reports, and industry periodicals. Their job is to find out whether the supposed next big idea is really new and deserving of monopoly protection. So they're turning to the Wikipedia concept, the online encyclopedia written and peer-reviewed by the public. John Dudas is the director of the Patent Office.
What we've learned from the Internet, that there are groups everywhere from MySpace and Wikipedia and to Travel Advisor, that users want to provide the knowledge they have. And I think that'll be revolutionary to our examiners to really tap into the entire world of researchers.
The Patent Office will filter out disreputable sources who may want to manipulate the system. Commenters will have to offer evidence of their expertise. Registered participants will vote on the information's reliability, and only the top vote-getters will be passed on to examiners. One designer of the Patent Office web solicitation, New York University law professor Beth Simone Novak, says public commenters will do more than just offer an opinion.
What they're being asked to do is to do research and to provide information in the form of publications that are directly relevant to determining whether a patent is, in fact, new enough and inventive enough to deserve the grant of monopoly rights that comes with the grant of a patent.
The Patent Office will evaluate the pilot program next year with an eye to expanding it. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
About all that's left to say is it could have been worse on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's mandatory health care and minimum wage, to name just two, issues you'd expect would occupy the minds of CEOs and small business owners alike. Energy policy is the latest rallying cry for business groups. More than a couple of corporations have begun talking about their positions on climate change and energy conservation. Not to be left out, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is getting in on the action as Congress considers global warming legislation. Today, the chamber announced it's hired a former Marine general to run its brand new Institute for Energy. We got Sam Eaton out from behind the Marketplace Sustainability Desk to explain things to us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Kai.
What exactly is it that the Chamber's hoping to do with this new Institute for Energy? I mean, they've been lobbying on Capitol Hill for a long time.
Well, Kai, they say they have a new mandate, and that's to work in Congress with federal agencies, with the states, to shape what they're calling common sense energy policies. They also say they support energy acquisitions from traditional to alternative sources, traditional being fossil fuels, alternative being anything from renewables to creating diesel fuel from coal. Basically, what this comes down to is the U.S. Chamber wants a seat at the table. They see the writing on the wall that climate legislation is probably going to pass in the U.S. at some point. They want a role in shaping that legislation.
Let's think about some specifics that they might ask for. Let's talk about drilling up in the Arctic. What about that?
The chamber says all options are on the table, mm-hmm. and this is probably why they're throwing a former Marine at this problem.
Yeah, General Jim Jones, former Commandant of the Marine Corps.
Exactly. I think what they're doing there is trying to determine how this debate is framed. What the chamber says is the national security component of this climate change debate is missing. If you frame it in that way, then obviously the U.S. needs more energy of all kinds.
Yeah.
So that would mean ANWR. That would mean natural gas out in the Gulf of Mexico. Basically, everything's on the table, from efficiency to fossil fuels.
Sure. How is this, though, going to be any different than all the lobbying that's gone on Capitol Hill in recent months and years over climate change, how to regulate it, whether or not it even exists?
I think what's different is we've seen a lot of corporations coming out addressing a carbon cap or, you know, basically regulations that would put a price on greenhouse gas mm-hmm. emissions. We're not going to expect that from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It's just too big of an organization. We're talking about the world's largest business organization, something like more than 300 million members. And so, you know, there are deep divisions within this organization as far as how to come up with a unified voice on addressing climate change.
Sam, let me get one more specific in here. What about the auto industry? I mean, the Chamber of Commerce must be paying attention to what Detroit's saying.
I'm sure they are, Kai, and this is a really timely issue in Washington right now. Congress is looking at the CAFE standards, which are the mileage standards on automobiles, mm-hmm. and boosting those, which would definitely have an impact on Detroit, the automobiles that they need to make in order to meet those standards. What makes this interesting, Kai, is the suggestions as far as who's funding this new institute. It's been suggested that the auto industry is one of the main funders of the Chamber's Institute for Energy, along with oil companies and electric utilities. And if that's the case, Kai, that would definitely shape how they address these issues on Capitol Hill.
Sam Eaton's a reporter from our sustainability desk. We've been talking to him about new efforts by the Chamber of Commerce to lobby on Capitol Hill about climate change. Sam, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
First thing to note is that there did used to be an actual wall there. Also, George Washington was inaugurated there. It's where the Bill of Rights was adopted. It's home to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the New York Stock Exchange. And today, it was put on the National Register of Historic Places. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports that's good news for property owners in the neighborhood near Wall Street.
The street pattern around Wall Street dates back to the 1600s. Most of the oldest buildings are from the 1800s, and around a quarter of the district's structures are already officially historic. In fact, perhaps the biggest surprise about Wall Street joining the National Register of Historic Places is that it wasn't there already. Stephen McLean is president of the National Architectural Trust.
There's no question that it creates a sense of cohesiveness among the population. It gives people a sense of honor. It can help commerce.
Of course, he says, the nation's financial capital was doing fine without it.
How that'll apply in Wall Street, I don't know, because Wall Street's so desirable already.
The neighborhood's character has been changing lately. The stock exchange is still there, so is New York's Federal Reserve. But banks have been moving uptown to other neighborhoods, and people have been moving in. Eric Deutsch heads the business improvement district in the neighborhood. He worries the designation could impede development there.
We would hope that this designation would not hinder the progress being made in a large part due to the federal assistance downtown. We'd also hope that property owners are given appropriate latitude and leeway as they make major improvements to the properties downtown.
Landlords may also be encouraged to renovate, however, since the new appointment makes them eligible for grants and tax breaks as long as they preserve the building's character. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, law firm salaries versus quality of life.
You know, I spent the last President's Day weekend holiday on a 9-hour conference call one day and doing several other projects that, you know, had to be done. They'd pay me a huge salary, and so my time, to a certain extent, is theirs.
We'll hear oral arguments, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shaved 63 points today, 0.5% to tidy up at 12,050. The NASDAQ shimmied down 27 points, 1.1% to end at 2340. The S&P 500 lost 13 points, nearly 1% to close at 1374. New Century Financial led the pack in that broad decline among subprime mortgage lenders I mentioned. On its heels came Novastar Financial with a plunge of more than 40%. Fremont General with a dive of 32%. Accredited Home Lenders Holding lost 26% worth of its grip. British Airways dropped 5.75% today. The airline caught the downdraft of an agreement last week between the U.S. and EU on preliminary plans for a deal to open transatlantic aviation markets. Overseas markets seem especially relevant today. The Frankfurt DAX trimmed 1%. London's FTSE and the Paris CAC 40 were right behind that magic number. Bond prices back home slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE. And by DuffyGilligan.com for supporting the Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, Secretary of State Rice releases the 2006 Country Report on Human Rights Practices. The Senate Armed Services Committee receives testimony on conditions at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And are you yawning while driving or working right now? The National Sleep Foundation releases its annual Sleep in America poll. This year, the focus is on the sleep habits of women. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's a rare trip to a restaurant these days where people actually plunk down cold, hard cash. Anything over $20 usually brings out the plastic. Credit card use is up at most retailers, including the nearly 1 million restaurants in this country. And in an age where identity theft is rampant, pressure's rising to make using those credit cards safer. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports one restaurant chain announced today how it plans to do that.
Forget what's on the menu. Tennessee-based Ruby Tuesday says it'll soon be serving up encrypted data at its 900 restaurants. By the end of April, the chain says it'll have installed credit card systems that will chew up your personal information without a trace after sending it for processing. Identity theft expert Bob Sullivan says it's about time.
The fact that they're encrypting their data, I mean, holy cow, it's 2007. I mean, haven't we been talking about this for years now? And at this point, you know, when somebody leaks a million credit cards, it's not even news.
Digital security breaches may seem like old news, but they are potentially a big problem for retailers. They're under pressure by lawmakers and credit card companies alike to do a better job of securing consumer data. That's in an age where identity theft costs us $56 billion a year. Bob Sullivan says restaurants are the perfect venues for such crimes.
It's like the only time in your life where you have to hand your credit card to someone who walks away and you can't see what they do with it.
Which is why some people think what Ruby Tuesday is doing only attacks part of the problem. Ben Popkin of the blog Consumerist.com says he likes that several other restaurant chains are working on bringing the credit card device right to the dining table.
Taking out the human element, because that's, you know, that's where the con man thrives.
The fear of being swindled doesn't seem to keep any of us from eating out. We're expected to spend $537 billion in restaurants this year alone. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Cutting prices can be a great way to build business, but Barnes & Noble learned today there can be too much of a good thing. The bookseller announced profits this year will fall well below what everybody had been expecting, in part because its discount programs are attracting too many customers. 40% off hardcovers adds up to a lot of money not made. Commentator Moira Mannion says prices aren't the only factor when it comes to selling books.
The Borders bookstore on Block E in downtown Minneapolis says it's looking for someone to take its lease, claiming a lack of foot traffic. I was part of that store's original staff back in August of 2002. We were excited about the new store, in which we naively assumed we'd have input. Before the store opened to the public, other employees and I, familiar with that part of downtown, asked the management when we would get a security guard and security mirrors. Management said they were unnecessary and brushed us off when we insisted they were. As soon as Block E Borders opened, it was infested. Homeless men slept and urinated in the chairs. Gangs listened to rap on headphones, often singing the obscene lyrics out loud. Prostitutes and drug dealers did business in our restrooms. Theft was rampant. My supervisor and I met with our manager and an HR person from Ann Arbor. We said that employees and customers felt unsafe. If we didn't act soon, the Barnes & Noble two blocks away, which had a security guard and security mirrors, would get all our business. The HR person said, "We'll certainly give this consideration." Nothing changed. Within 10 months, all but a few of the original, talented, intelligent staff quit. Why didn't management listen to its employees? Because wage slaves are to be seen and not heard. The cog should never tell the machine how to operate. Now Block E Borders will shut its doors, while the nearby Barnes & Noble thrives. I know, because that's where I shop.
Moira Mannion lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our homepage is marketplace.org. The Chicago Bar Foundation kicked off a fundraising campaign today. It's asking well-paid lawyers in the Windy City for as much as $500 to help the less fortunate, defined in this case as legal aid lawyers who make less than $40,000 a year. Meanwhile, first-year associates at a top firm in New York City are bringing down $160,000. Not bad for a job right out of law school. Partners say it's just to thank their associates for working hard in these boom times. But Ashley Milne-Tite reports it's probably not just gratitude.
John Plachet is a fourth-year associate at a top New York City law firm. He got a $20,000 raise last year. When his firm announced salary hikes across the board in January, he received another $20,000. At 30 years old, he's on $210,000 a year. He says he knows what's behind his good fortune.
Wall Street and Wall Street bonuses.
He says firms like his do a lot of work for investment banks and hedge funds. Some lawyers end up defecting to work in-house at those companies, and pay at those places has been breaking records recently. That puts pressure on the law firms.
So to keep talent, basically, the law firms have to keep raising pay to keep up with Wall Street.
That, he says, has a knock-on effect at elite firms across the country. Bill Urquhart agrees. He's a senior partner at Los Angeles law firm Quinn Emanuel Urquhart Oliver & Hedges. After news of the New York raises rampaged across the internet, his firm announced it would match the hikes.
For law firms like ours, you really don't have a choice but to pay what the market is demanding you pay. Otherwise, you start either a quick or a long-term decline.
He says he and his rivals are in a fierce battle for the best law school students in the country. Once they've tapped those superior legal brains, they want to keep them. Urquhart says attrition is not a big problem at his firm, where the road to partner is short, but an unprecedented 37% of associates do leave their firms within 3 years, before firms have had a chance to recoup their investment. Some move on within the legal profession, others quit law altogether. John Plachet says during his first year as a lawyer, half his contemporaries left before the year was up, some because of the demands of the office. He says the call of the BlackBerry is one thing, cancelled vacations and non-existent weekends are another.
You know, I'd spent the last President's Day weekend holiday, on a 9-hour conference call one day and doing several other projects that, you know, had to be done. They pay me a huge salary, and so my time, to a certain extent, is theirs because that's what they pay for.
Plachet is fairly sanguine about his lot, not just because of the money, he says, but because he has a great boss, someone he says treats him like a human being and doesn't casually land him with overnight assignments. Not everyone's so lucky. Kelly Schmidt is a reporter for California legal paper The Recorder. She's polled a number of associates, asking whether they'd rather have the big raises or earn less and have more free time.
The answer is often we'd rather get a little bit less and have a better work-life balance. And with these raises, some of the associates brought up the concern that they don't want their billable hour requirements to go up. They don't want to work more in order to get this increase in their paycheck.
She says what they would like is a little more recognition for their efforts. Still, at least those fat raises help young lawyers pay off their student loans. James Leipold is executive director for NALP, a trade association of law schools and law firms.
Most law students graduate with more than $70,000 in debt just in law school loans.
And he says despite the big hikes at corporate firms,
the rise in average law school debt has also continued to outpace the salary gains.
Things are harder for lawyers in the public sector, whose starting salaries are a quarter of those at first-tier corporate firms. John Plachet has lasted 4 years, but is he in this for the long haul? He says given that just 8% of first-year associates eventually make partner,
I have no delusions about making partner or staying in law forever.
In the meantime, though, he's happy to invest a chunk of his high earnings and enjoy the good life when he has time. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes, cubicle life has made this a tough one when colleagues are being loud on the phone, but here's a cautionary tale about listening too closely to your coworkers. Walmart fired a systems technician today for recording telephone conversations between the company's PR department and a New York Times reporter. The four recordings were made between September of 2006 and January of this year, but the technician went farther with his surveillance. He also intercepted text messages sent from people outside the company as well. No names were named, but the company says it did tell the New York Times about the recordings earlier today. Also, Jim Balsillie, co-CEO of BlackBerry maker Research in Motion, has resigned. The move follows an announcement the company will restate some past earnings reports. It needs to take about $250 million off its books due to improper accounting for backdated stock options. But Balsillie and his co-chief are helping to defray the costs. They've agreed to pay the company up to $5 million Canadian dollars apiece. That's about $4 million U.S. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 63 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq lost 27 points, about 1.1%. The S&P 500 fell 13 points, almost a full percent there. Marketplace's producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, cybercrime hits the big time.
I was in a formal meeting with very impressive people. And they said, we are interested in your help in more difficult investigations that require computers. And it became pretty clear over the conversation that they were speaking of industrial espionage.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.